Well, this will be awkward. And we're back. Welcome once again to another Oscar Sprint Profile from Mike. Mike and Oscar is what you are listening to. I am your co-host, Mike One. This is co-host also Mike.
Also Mike here. And dude, you've been predicting one of these indie movies was going to break out.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty happy about this. I hope the momentum sustains. It feels like A24 is getting behind it for an Oscar push as well. We'll get into all of it. But we're doing the 8th grade Oscar Sprint Profile today. And that's what we're tuning in for and what you're going to hear throughout your ears for the next hour or so, I guess. And we'll see how it goes. The spoiler section for this is going to be weird. Everything about this is going to be weird. This is a kind of a weird film. But Bo Burnham and his feature-length directorial debut.
Yes.
Getting into it. What do we want to start here?
He's going to have a career for 50 years.
Yes. We said in a previous episode, I've been such a big fan of his, and I've tweeted about it and whatnot, but everything about him, everything he's done thus far has been very of the moment and very culturally relevant and moving. And this movie really was no exception. I don't think I expected it to be anything else, but it still was not what I expected it to be.
There's great structure for his stand-up comedy specials.
Yes.
I would agree with that fact. He does really have a through line, and he has meta jokes for this. That's why you love him. The meta jokes
from the beginning
and the end, the way he sets things up and then pays them off by the end.
But it was nice to see him take the helm of a feature-length production. We're going to get into all of it. Non-spoiler section is how we start off. And also, Mike is going to start like he always does with a little production profile of 8th grade.
Going to begin with cast and crew, yes, written and directed by Bo Burnham, stand-up comedian who kind of launched his career as a viral video star.
He's like one of the first YouTubers that like understood what that mechanism could do.
In high school, he was rapping and he made up a lot of songs. He wrote a lot of his own songs. I don't know. I didn't rewatch any of these videos.
He was a theater kid that rapped. This is why I've also been so excited to do this one, because I've been like creepily stalking his career for a genuine the last decade or so.
Right.
So I know way too much about him as it is. Nothing uncomfortable going on here.
I like the way his hair falls across his eyebrows. He was great in The Big Sick as one of the friends at the comedy show there.
Yep.
He was also in Rough Night. His comedy specials, Make Happy, that was the one I've seen. The other one was called What, I believe. Those are the two Netflix specials. he was the writer and star of Zack Stone is Gonna Be Famous on MTV. He's also been on a lot of other TV shows, Key and Peele, et cetera, et cetera. Also, he's 6'5".
Yeah, he's a tall dude. Tall, lanky dude. And he makes a lot of comments about that in his work.
Said he was born to a sports family, but length doesn't equal talent. He said throughout the production promotional tours there.
That's something we can relate to without the height, I guess.
I don't have height or talent.
Right. Yes. We were born to sports families. What I'm saying.
Correct. Starring Elsie Fisher as Kayla Day.
It's so fluffy!
She was a voice of Agnes in the Despicable Me series. She's also been in Mike and Molly, Raising Hope, McFarlane USA, and the Axe Murders of Villisca. Which one of those titles don't belong?
Very eclectic career is what it is.
Mom and Dad have a little breakdown on what they let their kid do for a few months.
They sneezed when they signed the contract, yeah.
Josh Hamilton is Kayla's dad, Mark Day. He is from Manchester by the Sea, Grace Point, American Horror Story, Dark Skies, Francis Ha, J. Edgar, Away We Go, Kicking and Screaming, all the way back to 1996 or 94 there.
Pretty established career, and yet still not someone I was all that familiar with prior to this turn.
Right. He's a recognizable face, and yet I can't like place him in any one of those
exactly
movies.
How
can you?
I am too. No, not at all. Especially Manchester by the Sea. Maybe he was the fire captain.
I think
it was
a smaller role in that one. I literally cannot place him in any of those movies. I know I've seen him 100 times.
Same here.
I'm turning into my parents.
There you go.
Emily Robinson is Olivia. My favorite character ever. She's the high school mentor kind of girl. She's from Transparent and Virgin Territory. Daniel Zolgadri is Riley, the worst ride home from the mall ever.
Fuck that kid.
Right. Don't we hate him? We hate him, but he's from Alex Strangelove. Very good in that. Fahrenheit 451. He's at the end of that movie.
Objectively very good in this, but he was just... Fuck you.
Ready Player One as well. Fred Hechinger is Trevor, also Alex Strangelove. He'll be coming out in Vox Lux and As They Slept. Imani Lewis is Ania from The Get Down and Star on The Get Down from Netflix. Most of the rest of the cast were actual 8th graders.
Yeah, I noticed that in the research for this. He actually just kind of took a school with the children already in it and some of the faculty already in it and just said, this is what we're filming.
That's a great rat tail.
Oh, my God.
You're in my movie.
I saw that on the Kimmel interview, that there's a band scene. We're probably not going to get to it. It's not intricate to the plot, but there's a band scene in this movie where the band instructor has a long rat tail down the middle of his back. The band scene was not supposed to be in this movie until Bo Burnham met that school's band teacher, saw the rat tail, and was like, we're having a band scene now.
And he's like, I couldn't resist it. I think the national anthem played by a bad middle school band is where our country's at right now.
Yes, perfect. Absolutely perfect.
So yes, I saw that too. I love that. Some Bo Burnham quotes, I guess, to open up the story.
I have them all memorized. What would you like?
He said, I wanted to make a movie about what I'm feeling now. I thought this was fascinating. He wanted to talk about loneliness and social anxiety, as he says it, based on his life now, because he was not necessarily an eighth grader like Kayla. He said that he grew to understand girls like her. They had always made the effort to understand guys like him throughout his whole life. And he had to really, you know, take a turn in his world to start to empathize with those people.
Big statement about adolescence. And I don't know if you cover this as well, because I'm a bad person. I don't read ahead. But he also said that he didn't come out of his pen as being about from the perspective of an eighth grade girl.
Right.
But in doing research for this role, for this movie, he noticed that a lot of the eighth grade people that he encountered on one doing research on YouTube, the guys would talk about Minecraft and the girls would be talking about emotions and retrospectives and feelings and all that. So it's kind of interesting to see that girls at that age seem to have more depth and more mentally developed, as if they always are, because we're just simpletons.
Yeah,
men.
That just might be a race we'll never win as men. Very, very true. But yes, in terms of this guy and what he admits about his childhood, he doesn't seem to say, this is the story of my childhood. No, this is a story of me being an artist and losing my shit in my 30s or my late 20s.
And it's kind of fascinating.
Which we can relate to
as
well.
We sure can. And it's kind of fascinating that perspective is what an eighth grader is. Like, do we ever really develop from what we come in adolescence, I guess, is kind of a big question.
Oh, but, God.
Yeah, right?
Oh, God. I might have a panic attack before we keep going right now. This movie was bad enough. Anyway, the food court scene in the mall, as were many of the dialogue scenes, a lot of improvisation involved. Now, we're going to talk about that later with the script. Is that a mark against the script? I think, and Bo Burnham thinks, he did not want this to sound like a cell phone commercial,
right,
where the kids are just like, hey, hashtag awesome, or hashtag whatever, give me a break. He didn't want it to sound like adults writing kids. He wanted the kids to actually speak how they do.
And yet that principal is the one that speaks like the cell phone commercial, trying to relate to the kids, which is kind of a stroke of genius.
The principal, and then, of course, the video, the sex education
Dab.
Video.
It's going to be lit.
Yeah, it's pretty funny stuff there. He wanted electronic music. No staccato strings.
Well, he got it.
Something more visceral. That's what he thought would be a tone setter for the kids and the electronic generation, the internet generation.
What is it
here
those kids are into these days?
Essentially, he wanted to, quote, sync the movie's heart rate with Kayla's. Or sync the audience's heart rate with Kayla's, he said.
I'm going to have a lot to say about score as we get into it.
And he thinks the music goes a long way in doing that, syncing heartbeats.
And I agree.
Teenagers are in on the joke, he says. They know they're a bit of a mess. They're self-aware in many ways. And that's how a lot of these kids in this movie are portrayed. Almost.
Did you know you were a mess as an adolescent?
Yes. To a degree.
See, I think I was too arrogant. I think I felt like I knew everything, which I did. No, I don't know that I was as mentally developed as these kids seem to be, in that knowing that I was
well,
so far
I was, so let's
all
move on. No, right. No, I don't. I can't. God, can I remember? I know I'm a mess now.
Exactly. That's how I feel now.
I know I'm a mess the last 15, 20
right,
years.
Exactly how I feel.
As far as my memory goes back, I know I'm a mess. So I don't know if I've changed that much.
Fair enough.
Going back to your original philosophical point, I'm glad we're, stressing
those. Do we
those
develop from eighth grade? Let's turn this into a big psychological endeavor.
So he says these kids are kind of self-aware, and the way they speak about big issues, they can just free flow and talk about all kinds
which
of heavy
is a big
stuff.
Theme which throughout the movie. Yeah.
They did it the food court. They do it throughout. But he didn't want to say that eighth graders know more than adults. What he did want to say, and I think this was, I'm paraphrasing a lot of interviews now. I think I watched three or four, where he said, I don't want to say that kids know more than adults. That they're more in touch with the internet, et cetera, et cetera. But adults know how to put on the front more. The kids are more transparent.
Wear their hearts on their sleeves, yeah.
They're more transparent. They may have one layer of facade built up already. Adults have, you know, years of practice.
It's like anything else. The children are more authentic, right? You know, I mean,
they say the darndest things, but they also...
The jello!
Yeah.
Rohypnol!
So he didn't want this movie just to be for eighth graders. The same way Apollo 13 is not.
This is not a movie for eighth graders. I mean, it is a movie for eighth graders, right. But I think the R rating is the first tip off that this is not a movie for eighth graders.
A clue!
Right.
The same way Apollo 13 is not just for astronauts. Of course, you know, he sees himself in these
kids. I don't come to
kids.
Your work and shit on your dreams, do I?
So rather than thinking necessarily that teens have the complexity of adults, I just want to wrap up this point in saying that he thinks, and to paraphrase him, we are all struggling.
Yeah.
And we're all struggling in that way, especially with
and
loneliness
really,
and social anxiety.
Anxiety, loneliness, depression, feelings of having these kind of duplicate lives that all of us feel we have at times. These are not only themes throughout this movie, but it's and why he's been able to kind of hone the message in this so effectively, I think. They've been themes throughout all his stand-ups as well. Okay. And he really gets to these raw emotional points in all of his works where he's kind of exposing himself.
I can't remember his stand-up that well. I just remember it.
I can recite
really
it
flowing.
Word for word if you'd like me to.
Maybe on a side after party, or what does Bill Maher call his after show?
The overtime, right?
So production notes. Those are the kind of the quotes I wanted to get to, but some production notes now. Elsie had rehearsals with her father's character, Josh Hamilton, and then with Burnham. That's it. The rest of the cast, there was no rehearsals, Burnham said, because he wanted Elsie to meet the actors the same way that she was meeting the characters in those scenes.
And he didn't let her read the script. I saw in an interview. He only let her read the script. He gave her the part. She came in, auditioned. She got the part. He let her read the script once, took the script away until filming.
Oh, really?
Because he didn't want her overthinking the part.
Good.
Yeah.
So he was a viral video star back in 2006. I think that had an effect on the early video stuff.
Yeah, you right think now. So, huh? Bold statement.
So that's really all I got. I went heavy on the quotes there. Not a lot of production notes. It was like the Bicycle Thief where he went into a village and basically used the actual inhabitants as actors. I thought that's a major piece of it.
Which is very unique, and also unique in that, sure, Bo Burnham is a quote-unquote new director, but he's also kind of lived out his upbringing in the public eye, which is really the first kind of, because of the internet, mm-hmm. And that's kind of no-brainer that this is so internet-focused, this movie, because this is how this guy's risen to fame, kept his fame, sustained a career. So it's really kind of a bizarre look at where we are currently in the zeitgeist. Let's talk about some specs for 8th grade.
Absolutely.
Written, directed by Bo Burnham, of course, in his feature-length theatrical directorial and writing debut. Debuted at Sundance, January 19, 2018. It went limited release on July 13th of this year and wide on August 3rd, just a couple of days ago. 94-minute runtime on an R rating, which Burnham wasn't thrilled with, and actually just recently, A24, today, we're recording this on Wednesday, August 8th, you'll probably hear it the day after, but Wednesday, August 8th, the studio took back its R rating, and they're giving free screenings of the movie throughout the country so 8th graders can go see it with their parents, which I think is awesome. I also think it's an Oscar push, but we'll get to it.
And Elsie mentioned on Late Night that she thinks it's pretty cool because it's a movie that should be seen parents and kids at the same time. It's
kind
of like a
Lady
Bird thing.
And that's kind of another message of this movie is it hones in on that meeting in the middle between kids, adults that used to be teens that are now trying to be adults that have to relate to teens that are growing up as teens in a new world than the adults. It's all that. It's really, really well done. Produced by A24 and Scott Rudin Productions, distributed by A24 as well. The budget is unknown as it usually is this early in the theatrical run. They don't really release it, but it does have some relatively surprising box office numbers, if not overall. The gross thus far, it's only been wide release, like I said, for a couple days, but its domestic gross thus far is $6.56 million. Not exactly huge, but the theater average is pretty damn impressive. Box Office Mojo keeps a list of the highest per theater average take domestically, but the minimum number of theaters a movie must have to qualify for this list anyway is being released in 600 theaters. Huh. During 8th grade's opening weekend, they only opened in 4 theaters, so clearly they wouldn't have made the list. They were short by a mere 596 theaters.
Just a few.
Right. However, the highest per theater average in history for an opening weekend is The Force Awakens, and it's nearly 60,000 per 4,100 theater average during its opening weekend in 2015. Eighth grade, while only opening in those 4 theaters, amassed in excess of $250,000. Its per theater average was 63,000 plus. So it's higher than the highest average ever for an opening weekend, obviously with a limited theatrical run.
So those people in Los Angeles, New York, they get a little lonely. They go to the movies.
Don't we all?
I mean, I miss living in New York, but...
You've made it to the big city? Obviously, the momentum didn't hold up as the movie went wide, but the critical adulation and praise certainly did. It sustained an 8.3 IMDb rating on 4,300 reviews, plus, which would put it right now in the IMDb top 250 if it sustains that number. Certified fresh Rotten Tomato score of 98% on 157 critical reviews, 3 of those being negative, while only 1 lone top critic claimed it rotten. What's up, Richard Brody from The New Yorker? How you doing?
Call him out.
One, come on, I got more to say about him.
Ugh.
Average critical score.
New Yorker.
Average critical score of 8.8 out of 10. My God, that is high. 88% audience score on 1,800 plus reviews with the average audience ranking of 4.3 out of 5. A 90 Meta rating, which is basically unheard of for a feature film, at least for as long as we've been doing this. It's tied with The Tale and 2 points behind The Rider, goddamn horse movie, for highest meta score for all movies in 2018.
Guess I gotta see The Rider.
45 Metacritic reviews, I don't. High with multiple 100s getting from critics. The low of 75, except for one lone review from ya boy, Richard Brody of The New Yorker, who gave it a 50.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, was not a fan of this movie, I guess.
Oh, and that's, of course, it's not a 50, so he's trying to sway the meta rating
down. He wants
down.
To be the bell curve, the one side of the bell curve, yeah.
He wants to be the anchor pulling down
pretty
the
much,
ship
yeah.
there. Oh, my God.
It's award seasons, though, and much to Sir Brody's dismay, this one is gathering momentum as the film's festivals pass. It's already won 6 awards, including Burnham winning the Audience Award at the Chicago Film Critics Awards for Best Narrative. Best Narrative featured a Burnham at the San Francisco International Film Festival, the Audience Favorite Award at Sundance London, and winning the Golden Space Needle Award at the Seattle International Film Festival for Best Film to Burnham and Best Actress to Elsie Fisher.
Cities like it. Critics like it.
It's getting, and this is the momentum. And again, if we're going to talk about the Oscar push, we'll talk about the Oscar lens in a minute. But when A24 stepped out and said, we want everyone to see this.
Right.
We're going to take away its R rating. We want everyone to see this for free, nonetheless.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that was a signal that they believe in this product. And when it comes time for the February push, the January push, I think this is going to be the vehicle they get behind.
Makes
that's
sense.
Just a prediction to me, but that's what it seemed like.
So this movie's coming out to tepid box office.
Yes.
And I wonder if it's enough to kind of be on the Academy's radar. Because let's face it, the Academy is swayed by box office. Florida Project, we could argue, was up there with movies last year that
sure.
got bigger noms. And yet it kind of fell off because it kind of was a blip.
Yeah, this isn't Get Out, right? I mean, this isn't something that's going to be this international huge hit and make this huge race statement and gender statement. This is a kind of a niche picture in a way. But my counter to what you just said is that the Academy widened, right? How many of those new members of the Academy do you think have children of their own, adolescent children of their own? That do want to see these movies and are going to be touched by something like this, I think it might have legs in that regard if it appeals to the parental
where I
side.
Where I hope it really creates waves is when it comes out on video while it's screener watching time.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I'm with you. On video so the public puts pressure on them to, you know, vote for it. So that's probably where it's got to time it right.
You're right. You're right. And I think, again, I think A24 knows that. I think, I hope... But I do think that this is, they're positioning this correctly so far.
So to segue kind of into our expectations, theatrical experience review here, I kind of was in 2 relatively empty theaters, unfortunately. Now, I saw it twice at the 9, 10 o'clock hour, the witching hour, I guess
That's
you'd
interesting.
Say. off-peak for MoviePass on last night. And I
was
in
tuned for Hollywood Hot Takes next week about MoviePass. We have some things to say.
Yeah, I was in an entirely empty theater.
See, that's interesting. I saw it midday, as I usually do, as a very sad, lonely adult male. I saw it midday on, I want to say, I don't remember what day, maybe a Sunday. Mm-hmm. It was Sunday. I think it was Sunday, actually. It wasn't packed, but there were people there. I was in the middle of a row, and I had people on either side of me in the row because there were enough people all throughout the theater that people had to sit. They couldn't have one person per row, you know what I mean? So there was people there. This isn't going to break huge box office numbers, and I don't think that's the point of it.
No, but again, Academy, they don't like those movies that just flash. It's rare that they vote for the movies that just flash or that are just a blip. That's why I keep thinking, like, First Reformed. I mean, nobody saw it.
You're so against First Reformed. This is going to be like the mini subplot of this year. It's you against First Reformed.
I'm trying to come around to it. I'm going to have to watch it again.
I know you are.
I was, you know, chatting with people on Twitter yesterday. They're very patient with me. They really are. They're good dudes. And I'm thinking about it. I actually wrote down a whole pair. I'm going to write an article about it for our website, whatever that comes.
Right, which is in the pipeline and it's coming before.
We're getting there. Yeah, we're writing articles.
Before Ready Player One becomes a reality is when we'll have our website.
Do we call them articles or posts? I just want to call them things.
You're the writer. I just
speak. Wrote seven things. They're coming.
But about your expectations, what did you expect for the movie specifically?
I know, awkward movie. I knew that from the trailer. That was made abundantly clear because I'm cringing and upside down in my couch watching the trailer. Now, when we reviewed that, we knew this was going to be like the underdog movie of the year, right? We talked about it that way, where Elsie was just going to be so put upon and we're pulling for her so hard.
This is a point you made previously, yeah. Right? Even the slightest glimmer of hope would be something we cheer for.
I figured to have a lot of sympathy earned through the crucible of nightmarish eighth grade cool kids.
So you were kind of prepared. I didn't know what to really expect. I expected awkward. I think that was pretty abundantly clear, like you said, but I didn't really know what to expect. Bo Burnham's a whack job, man. I mean, he goes from like Hollywood to San Diego by way of Cheyenne, Wyoming. You know, he gets to the point, but he takes a circuitous route and he goes all over the map to get you there.
Correct. I think it's a fairly tight script, but it's amazing that these scenes, they really dupe you in many ways. Like you're taken along, like you said, a circuitous route, and maybe it's because the kids are kind of improvising. You suffer.
Yeah.
Movie, and it's excruciating at times.
Mm-hmm.
I cling to the jokes made like life rafts in the ocean, like volleyballs with heads painted on them. I really, really cling to them. So I wonder if they're that funny or if I'm just so
desperate to get out of the
tension
awkwardness.
Is just so high that I need that relief so much. But I do want to say that this movie delivers on an artistic dramatic level that I wasn't expecting an Academy Award movie, bottom line.
Well,
and I think in terms of quality, where I see the movie, I don't care what anybody else thinks about it. I don't care who's going to see it. And my thesis statement for today is that this quacks like that Oscar movie, just to shorten that phrase.
I don't think you're wrong. We'll get into it. But again, the drama and the awkwardness and the tension is something that you brought up. And that's what I want to get into with production values. I think the score has a hell of a lot to do with that.
Yeah.
The score, first of all, I don't download scores. I downloaded this score. It was so effective. And it became almost a character. The score was kind of the antagonist. To the viewer, anyway, not to the characters, but to us, the score played such a role in the plot itself. It was more responsible for putting us
on edge.
It's
interesting you say that because he said he wanted you to sink in with her heartbeat. Right? She's feeling anxiety.
Exactly.
I mean, she's literally having a panic attack at a few points.
Pool party is like the biggest.
That's the seventh circle of
hell.
Yeah,
oh my God. And it was doing no small part to the score. I think this score is phenomenal. I think it's one of the best ones I've ever seen. I put it up there with Dunkirk from last year, honestly.
So,
it's a different way, but I loved it.
But it makes sense that it's, you know, freaking you out.
Oh,
because
yeah.
it's her inner monologue.
It's basically, it's the audience antagonist, but it's also Elsie's emotion.
Right.
It's what she's feeling.
Which is her antagonist in many ways.
Yeah.
So that's excellent. I guess to jump into some production values beyond the sound, Mike, cinematography, production design, editing, I think those are the kind of three big ones to talk about here. cinematographer, we always talk about the texture of the shot, the actual framing, the mise-en-scene, whatever, the actual framing, what it looks like, right? The camera movement in this is phenomenal. And
that one shot from this pool party where it's a crane shot, it's zoomed in on Ellie, it zooms out, and then the crane shot pans down to see the rest of the kids in the pool. Yes. And then we're followed immediately by a tracking shot, a couple tracking shots of Ellie actually walking up to the pool. It was phenomenal. So enrapturing and enveloping.
Yeah, we always talk about the screenshot of cinematography and how you would grade that category, right? Mm-hmm. The quote-unquote paint on the canvas, right? We never talk about the skill it takes to move the goddamn camera. That's why I think a Mission Impossible Fallout should be up there.
Right.
It's amazing how he uses the camera movement to tell the story as well, because once he stops moving the camera in that scene, it means so much. Mm-hmm. It means so much. I'll get into it in spoilers, but it's the skill that this guy has in
it's not
directing
fair.
The thing.
It's not fair. It's his debut, goddammit.
Yeah, so I'm going to argue for the composition when we get into Oscar lens. But now, production design and editing serve the story, and I think the costumes and makeup serve the story. It's authentic, right? It feels authentic.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
Is any of it showy to the point where we really want to identify it as getting into Oscar?
It depends on how you feel about the movie overall, because editing and Best Picture a lot of times throughout history are very intertwined as far as nominations go.
Now, the editing is showy for the pool party montage, right? It's showy for a moment later on in the story. When this gets into long takes, we don't have a lot of editing.
No.
It gets theatrical. We're just, you know, yes, he goes back and forth even in the crazy car scene at the end, but I have to study it more.
I think there's no doubt skill involved in all three of those categories. I don't know that it'll get nominated for any of those three. Production design, I mean, what's the bar for production design? Is production design you going into that world? The effectiveness of you going into that world of an eighth grade middle school?
Or do you have to create a world like Isle of Dogs?
Exactly. So I don't know what the bar is for what the Academy wants to do. Because if the bar is going into the eighth grade world, my God, when the guy is walking down the hall fake shooting kids and they're practicing the school shooting thing.
Can a fish and a woman fall in love in your world? Then it's production design nominated. I'm sorry, I interrupted your school shooting bullshit.
You know, thank you.
Joke that I just, like, my brain froze and trying to think of it.
But there's something so surreal about that kind of moment that, yeah, you're totally there. So if that's what production design is, according to the Academy, then of course it'll be nominated. I don't think it will.
I don't think so either. So I guess, do you want to do Oscar lines right now, maybe?
Might as well. Let's get into it.
Yeah. So we might as well do it.
This needs to be nominated for score. It needs to be nominated for score. I know you had your issues with it.
I just didn't. I was hoping you would convince me of something else, because you last night you told me I have two categories for sure.
Score is 1,000% for me. It needs to be it.
Because I come away with this saying, oh, it's going screenplay all day, especially with a weaker year for screenplay.
I think it's
going
to be either screenplay or director was my other one.
And I'm going to go through it beat by beat and spoilers, and I just think screenplay is going to be there. Some of the drama's on the level of some big movies that we've reviewed.
But is that
the sophistication with Get Out and Lady Bird?
Okay, I don't disagree. Yeah. I think you're making a good point. But since he had total control of this movie, I mean, he's the lone screenwriter. He's the lone director on it. I don't think he's going to get both. I think the Academy is going to say, great debut. We have 9 other slots, though, we don't want to give. It's not like the best picture of the year, so we can't nominate him for everything. So we have 9 other slots we want to give. We'll pick one of these for you. So that's why I say I think director or original screenplay, one of those is going to be a nomination, at least. I don't think a win at this point anyway, but I think it'll be a nomination.
I'm just looking for it. Now, a lot of these movies can come out.
Sure. We don't.
And bomb. Or just be duds or be whatevers that don't make a lot of difference and sway the Academy.
You're
at the end
director
of the day.
Looks packed though.
So director looks packed.
Yeah, I totally agree. So I think you're right in saying that screenplay seems to be the way to go with this.
And a lot of the big heavy contenders are going to be adapted screenplays, which opens up opportunities for First Reformed and Sorry to Bother You, and of course this movie, Eighth Grade.
When First Reformed wins an Oscar, do you punch the TV or do you throw something at it?
I like Paul Schrader. I really do. I always have. And you antagonized me with Taxi Driver the other day, and now First Reformed. I think ethically, I hate that movie. I also think it touches a million nerves because I'm formerly religious.
We'll probably have to do an OSP for it, but that time will come.
We may have to do that sooner than later. Okay, so
Elsie Fisher.
Lens, Elsie Fisher.
Let's talk about her.
Let's talk about her performance in the movie. Because
what's the line for a best actress? What is a best actress?
If she does 17 things with her face during one conversation with a cool kid, and you want to murder that cool kid because of how she's feeling and how her facial tics are letting you know she's feeling a certain way, and how she withholds her, like... It's almost like her eyes are almost starting to bug out of her head, but she only reddens her forehead a little bit. How does she do that?
The facial expressions, the faux confidence that she has to put forth in these videos that are basically for nobody but herself in terms of, I want to talk about being yourself. I want to talk about making friends. I want to talk about having confidence.
Yeah.
In these YouTube videos that she's making, and she's putting forth this face for everyone to see, but on the inside, she's dying, and we see that. If a best actress, again, for much like I said for production design, if a best actress is you're supposed to believe that this person is this character on screen, isn't this the best performance of the year so far?
It's up there for me.
Right?
What she's pulling off...
I don't mean to be hyperbolic,
subtextually.
But...
You know, we talked about Toni Collette and what's on the surface there and just the contortionist facial expressions that she's making. Like, to me, she's still the quote-unquote front-runner.
Same here.
But I do think what this girl's doing in this movie is sophisticated enough to be up there in my top two. I mean, she's in my top two.
Now, she got the part... Another Bo Burnham quote. She got the part because... Burnham said during, I think it was the Kimmel interview.
Yes, I love that
quote. When he was meeting with people, Elsie Fisher was the only one that was scared but playing confident in the audition.
And all the other kids felt like really confident, playing scared. Pretending to be scared.
Right. So maybe this is more of Elsie Fisher is really Kayla Day, and maybe she's not acting at all. I don't know where the bar is.
That same interview, she has a Dungeons and Dragons club.
Yes, yes.
So, yeah, correct. I read fantasy books. I know that we people are weirdos. So, yeah, I love her. She's my hero.
So, I don't know. I think it's going to be a very interesting case study. I think it's one of the top two performances so far. I'm going to reserve judgment of pushing for her until time passes.
I wonder if people will write her off and just say, okay, get all the best child actor awards, right? Get
right.
the Critics' Choice Award that the kid from Florida Project got last year. You know,
or be hypocritical. Oh, how hard is it for a teenager to play a teenager? You know?
True.
Because this is an adult industry.
I just think when she makes herself blush instantaneously and then somehow it stops blushing.
Yeah.
In the same shot, I can't get over what she's doing. Of course, she's improvising, and that helps probably.
Yeah, okay, but she's still doing. There's so very interesting case study. I can't wait. I'm very curious to see how this performance holds up as the months pass.
I loved Charlize Theron and Tully. I really enjoyed that movie, Diablo Cody. By the way, awesome. But
could be another original screenplay. No.
Yeah, and that screenplay is really cool. But I think she's above Charlize Theron. I think Charlize Theron is doing a great job, but it's not as showy as this performance.
I'll say this so far for Elsie Fisher. The only performance I've seen thus far that I'm sure is better than hers is Toni Collette in Hereditary.
That's excellent. So, no, the last kind of area we wanted to talk was Mark Hamilton, the dad.
So he's not going to get nominated.
No.
But he should. He was so good as... I am terrified of the notion of being a father to an adolescent teen, specifically girl, because I obviously have no experience being a woman, so I can't relate to them at all. But being a father of a teen in general, he's chasing it the whole movie. And he just wants what's best for her, but he knows he needs to be standoffish because she's growing into an independent self, but he needs to be there because she's her only line of support. And...
He's walking on eggshells,
yes.
But he needs to help her.
Yes.
And to me, it is a central conflict of the movie, and I love how it plays out.
Same here.
I'm so proud of it.
Heartwarming.
I'm so happy for it. It's subtly brilliant, but it's brilliant nonetheless. And you kind of think you're sucked into the fact that it's kind of one note where he's just the goofy dad making the dad jokes. and you're sucked into that's your introduction, and there's so much more involved.
Right,
there.
And it's you find out it's purposeful and all that. Yeah.
There's a million layers to this guy with that smile that's a little scared, but also somehow still genuine. And his performance is terrific.
He throws the $20 at her too. He's like, here, just take this.
Yeah, he's my number four right now. I mean, Black Panther cast, Hereditary cast are above him, but
I would love. He's great. I don't think it'll happen for him. I would love to see it, but I think his performance was awesome for the role he needed to play. And he gets the big speech at the end of the movie, like a true supporting actor nominee does.
But that's the problem. Michael Stuhlbarg didn't get nominated last year. I don't know if he will get nominated this year. The speech-giving performances of yesteryear don't necessarily get the applause and the accolades they used to. So I guess we kind of mentioned a lot of things I wanted to say about the script, but I do want to say that when Bo Burnham needs to handle a big scene, he knows exactly what he's doing in this movie.
He's got maturity beyond
the movie. It's unassuming in many ways.
Yeah.
So if you don't think a major event's going to happen, or looking back on it, you kind of recontextualize, well, maybe it's not a major event for the world. We're not saving the world like a Marvel movie, but this is a major event for her. You know, the shadow day at the high school.
It's a milestone in growing, yeah.
One trip to the mall with friends. And it's insane how all these moments build up to the crescendo at the end. I'm so happy with the script upon rewatch. And I think this movie is... it's not a law of diminishing returns. It's a law of increasing returns. So watch this movie once and see it again for even more fun, for even more aesthetic appreciation.
Especially if you have any children in your life of any age, really.
Don't judge me for saying aesthetic appreciation. And it helps you relate to kids, of course, but yeah. I'm going to talk about something before we go into spoilers.
Well, go ahead, because it's a watch from both of us.
A watch from both of us.
Yeah.
We want to mention our friends at the Casual Cinecast. They're another podcast.
Another great pod, yeah.
That really like we like to listen to. They often do a thing of, I kind of termed it, they didn't term it this, but if this, then what? Basically, they talk about, if you like this movie, what's another movie that you would recommend? Now, ooh. I kind of went through a whole group of movies, and I'm like, no, it's not that. It's not Juno. It's not Perks of Being a Wallflower, The Edge of 17. It's not Easy A. It's not Lady Bird, even, right? It's not those movies.
All
as much
those
as
you
I...
mentioned, it's probably closest to Lady Bird, but you're right. It's not Lady Bird.
I can't think of, like, why is it not connect? Is it The 400 Blows? Who the fuck knows? I haven't seen The 400 Blows for 25 years. I saw it when I was an eighth grader. So I don't
In English
know.
Class, probably, knowing your upbringing.
Is it something like Fish Tank, which is a weird Michael Fassbender indie British right. movie from a couple years ago? But even that, you know, over the top plotted movie, right? To me, this movie reminds me of, so if you like eighth grade, to me, this movie reminds me of Lost in Translation. It's from Sofia Coppola.
Go on.
Because it, like Bo Burnham said, it's not a movie about quote unquote childhood anxiety necessarily, or only childhood anxiety and loneliness. It's a movie about loneliness and social anxiety. And that's essentially what Lost in Translation is, where she starts at the beginning of that movie and how she slowly but surely branches out, even though she has more of a built-up facade, like he says about adults. That to me, the way this movie pays off is a lot like that, and
I think
that's where I'm at.
Your overall point.
It's a weird comparison,
yeah,
but that was the only one I kept sticking with.
Your overall point is what I would kind of trend towards. I don't know that I've seen something like this before. I don't know that I could relate it to anything that's... I mean, it's pieces right. of Juno. It's pieces of Lady Bird. It's pieces of Percy being Wallflower.
Beasts of the Southern Wild. It's right. not any of those.
No, but there's no analogous, you know, one-to-one relationship right. to anything. So I think, I mean, you want to call it Lost in Translation. I by all means, yeah, I can understand that the correlation you're
I'm
making.
Stretching like a
lunatic. Well, you have
lunatic
to. Yeah,
here,
you have to. Yeah. I think that's the point of this. And good job by raising the question by Casual Cinecast, which, by the way, guys, there's a ton of decent movie podcasts out there, but I really do think, as far as we're going to fluff any up. There's a couple that are really, really good as far as what we try to do here, and they also shine the light on it. Casual Cinecast is one. Next Best Picture is another one. In Session Film is another one. We really
friends
like those. Yeah, they're friends of ours. We talk to them on Twitter, but we really do think we talk to them for a reason. We really like what they're doing, and if you have a moment to check them out, please do so. But yeah, it's really an interesting question. I don't know that I could... See, I wouldn't come up with Lost in Translation. I just wouldn't go that way, you can't stay in the coming-of-age genre and make a comparison.
So I went a little further, right? Because what are movies about loneliness and social anxiety? Typically, you start with a protagonist like that.
Mm-hmm.
It turns into Pan's Labyrinth, Alice in Wonderland, The Wizard of Oz. It turns into a fairy tale. Writers are so hesitant, and many of us are so cowardly, to just take loneliness and social anxiety and address them on the head. Annihilation has to use so many metaphors to talk about depression or whatever. Mulholland Drive has to use so many metaphors to talk about. Lars and the Real Girl uses a gimmick to talk about this. And most movies use gimmicks. Even Charlie Kaufman, his stuff uses an array of gimmicks and a meta gimmicks adaptation of Being John Malkovich. So this is a movie that just addresses it. Coldly, not coldly, but warmly, but directly.
Right. I could make a comparison. I mean, I don't know why, and this probably says a lot about my mind. The one I keep thinking of is the Full Monty, because you're basically up against it. You have no choice but to keep going forward into this plan that you have. In the Full Monty, obviously, it's a more convoluted plan, and this one's just a day in the life of an eighth grader. But you have no choice but to really expose yourself to a bunch of people and be pressured into playing this role that you have to do because you have no choice.
But it's interesting that you're making another comparison about a movie about adult crisis.
And that's the overall point. Do we really mature from where we are in adolescence? And you can lay on the couch and I'll put on glasses and we can talk about it. But great question by Casual Cinecast. Dance. All right, let's dance. Spoilers ahead.
This is a spoiler. Warning.
Spoilers. 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 Spoilers.
Mike, and Oscar Sprint, spoilers!
This is the spoiler section for 8th grade Bo Burnham's feature directorial debut, The Elsie Fisher Vehicle. If you do not want to hear about the spoilers for 8th grade, if you have not seen the movie yet, this is a good time to pause, go check out the movie, come back and hit play on us later on. If you have seen the movie, you want to know our thoughts on the twists and turns, or if you just want to know what happens in the movie, this is where you want to be. But otherwise, we are all spoilers all the time going on. So I have to start with this question. Would you rather fuck an apple pie or a banana?
An apple pie. That's a question.
It's an interesting, I mean, I say that in jest, but here's what I really want to ask. When you watched American Pie for the first time,
yeah,
I have to feel like you weren't as skeeved out at that age, some 15 years ago, as you were watching basically the same thing in this movie.
I'm going to answer a question with a question. Which scene skeeved you out more on the first watch?
Between those two?
Those two plus the peach and call Me By Your Name. Obviously, when you rewatch those scenes, they have more to do. American Pie is just him.
See, Call Me By Your Name was more sweet and tender. American Pie and this one were more, we have to figure this out.
Yeah, the
sexually.
Way they dramatized the peach.
So scene. I when I watched American Pie, I thought it was funny. Right. When I watched pretty much the exact same scene in this movie 15 years later, I'm like, oh my God, no.
However, this scene also, again, we talk about the father-daughter a relationship being the most important of the movie in terms of structure. I think that banana scene really lends you to think about the father's character. He keeps notes on his phone about little stupid things he likes and doesn't like.
Right.
He remembers conversations and goofy things they have. He doesn't let her hang in that awkward scenario. Same way that Armie Hammer didn't let Elio hang himself right? Enough rope to hang himself. He could have just stuck the knife
in. So maybe there's
your comparison.
Is this a different version of a relationship than Call Me By Your Name was? Is this that type of movie?
No, I'm just saying this father is not
cruel.
You're making
a good point. You're
right. He's not. He's a kind man.
It's a loving
He won't let his daughter humiliate herself in that scene. He guesses what she's up to a little bit. And he kind of just makes the whole thing about himself. But she still kind of reads that because she sees him trying to save her. That's why I think the drama of this movie is on the level of some serious Academy Award films that we've talked about and dissected and spoke about in terms of being sophisticated drama, like Get Out and Lady Bird and Phantom Thread. That scene, if you break that scene down, there's 1,000 things going on.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Woo.
Let's start with a plot overview. And the plot isn't that convoluted.
Right. Video Be Yourself, right from the beginning. So we open with a YouTube video of her. It's amazing to rewatch that and think about all the shit that's going on for her.
Yeah.
It foreshadows so much. It gets you into
those videos end up being the conscious of the movie or the narrative, the omnipresent narrative that kind of move the movie along or at least foreshadow what's going to come in the next scene.
So she gets up, goes to school, really awkward montage of her looking down, walking through the classrooms. You got the montage of the kids doing goofy things with their retainers and the markers. Totally eighth graders. It's so eighth graders. I used to work with those kids and they're nuts. Anyway, they're still kids. They're not yet the adults.
They're like
the high school
amoebas.
Kids are.
Yeah.
Right. They're still goofy kids.
Right.
If you walk them in a park during a summer camp, they'll just walk on all
exactly.
the woods and the
yeah.
trees.
And we
rocks.
Were no different. We were,
of course,
we were just
lunatics.
Weird. Yeah.
Superlatives at the assembly, time capsules given out. She's also voted most quiet. That scene is crushing. It also introduces the theme for whatever that crush kid name, the boy.
I have
Bieber
yeah,
there.
Bieber. Tyler is the kid's name. It's Kayla's crush. And it's such a Fast Times homage in that every time he's on screen from when you first meet him, he's walking in slow-mo
right.
with
yeah,
his
can't
heavy,
hardly
yeah.
waste the pair.
Right.
Now, that's the Do It Again, and then the Not Another Team movie is the parody of
yes.
that. She's the only one going in slow motion.
Right, right.
Does she realize she's moving in slow motion?
Why is she going that slow?
So we have her, quote unquote, invited to the pool party as she leaves school that day, because it's just a week in the life of an eighth grader. She resists to call to adventure here, talk about hero's journey stuff, as the dad asks her at the dinner table if she's going to the pool party. She's like, no way, that in hell, the kid hates me. And then the dad gives her his first speech, meeting yeah. with the mentor, gives that speech to her, and it feels like it fails, right?
Yeah.
But it doesn't
no.
fail.
And she ends up... And
she goes the next day.
When
I
saw
father.
Her walking into that party, the first thing I thought of, my God, this woman is so much more brave than I am. Because there's no way.
She is my freaking hero.
Oh my God, she's awesome.
Because like I said before, this pool party is the seventh circle of hell.
Mm-hmm.
I'm having a panic attack
totally.
For her. I'm having a panic attack in the theater. I'm almost want to be upside down on my chair.
1,000%.
That is the scariest scene. And then when the fucking pool door doesn't open all the way.
She has to slink out. Oh, my God. Everything about that, the first introduction to the pool scene.
It's a fucking Paul Greengrass
yeah.
movie
oh
with the shaky
awesome.
Cam of her in the bathroom breathing heavy.
She has a full-on panic attack
yeah.
at a fucking party that she's not even invited to, which she
oh
went to reluctantly.
Oh, my God. Yeah, just brilliant. And the camera's moving like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, shaky cam, and then you talked about the big pan and the really
it's my
crazy thing
scene.
It's
yeah.
doing. The showy camera work works so well, and it's scary because you get the kids in braces. I fucking, it's terrified of eighth graders. But you have the kids in braces. And then once the camera stops moving, she meets Gabe.
Yeah.
She actually makes a friend.
Yeah.
He's a kind kid who just wants
and
to do goofy
this,
things.
And it's this constant pull between, you
play
know,
a game with her. Like,
do you want to be a cool kid or do you want to be yourself? And it's she knows she wants to talk to Gabe because he's the only one talking to her, but she knows that Gabe's not cool. She wants to impress whatever the girl's
yes.
house it was name.
And the crush.
Yeah.
She wants to impress
She wants to stay in the cool kids.
They play that music
oh,
again.
Oh, it's such a good tension.
And yet... there's always like stakes behind the text here because even the game that her and Gabe play, it's holding their breath underwater, which if they screw it up, they're dead, right?
And you when, think he's dead for a minute. He doesn't come up.
So that's like playing on with your nerves. And I just think that's so brilliant. So she has this just nightmarish phone call with her dad, all right? It's just, it's ruining me where she's outside the party. All the kids are playing in the other room and talking and laughing and having fun. And she's like, "Dad, please take me home." And of course, he's trying to pry and question her a little bit about what happened, whatever. It's brutal. He's like, "I can come in an hour," because he's trying to like kick her out of the nest a little bit here. Oh, so there's a lot of that going on. And then the crush walks in and he's like, I charge my phone. And she...
I charge it, too, sometimes.
Says the most awkward thing in the history of kids
or people.
I charge my
phone, too. Yeah.
And I want it to die.
Yes.
So right at her, quote-unquote, rock-bottom moment of the movie so far...
Digs a little deeper.
not just that. She does the most courageous thing ever. She gets in front of the room of kids, takes the microphone, and sings a song on the karaoke.
Yeah, she... Wentz goes from calling out for help, literally basically crying for her dad to pick her up.
Has the most awkward back and forth crush, with her crush ever.
And she just keeps going forward. She keeps pushing forward. It was astounding.
So it says something about humiliation. It says once it happens, you can kind of, all right, fuck it.
Who gives a shit, right?
You get that mentality. So all that anxiety for what? All right, that's the worst thing that can happen. Fuck it. Let me go stand in front of everybody and just sing. And I'm gonna be confident no matter what. So you intercut the another YouTube video there, which is kind of intercut throughout the movie, which is brilliant. Now, the next day at school, she gives a letter to the cool girls, which we thought the converse with the crush was bad. Those kids, I hated those girls so much. They're the worst people. They're great
job.
Great job. I love the portrayal, and I died inside.
Yeah.
And that's where some of her best acting of
because she still, she wants so badly to be accepted by the cool kids. She wants to be the status.
The eagerness in her face, and then her forehead just like reddens a little bit, and then it stops. I'm so impressed with her acting in that scene. That would be my showcase of the movie for her, in my opinion. But it's amazing. She gives that fake smile at the end of it, which says volumes.
Yeah. And they don't look up from their phones once.
All right. Now, you have that undercurrent of danger and stakes because we're talking about loneliness and ostracism and social anxiety here. Well, you take that to the end. What is it? It's school shooter, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to take the psychology and simplify it.
No, it's a good point.
If you think about your perception of what are the loneliest, most fucked up people do, they shoot people and in mass. So you have a school shooting training session. Now, it's in the hallway.
Bang, you're dead. Bang, you're dead.
That's fucked up.
Oh, my God.
And a little funny in a dark way.
I mean, there's definitely a punchline to it, but it's like, what the fuck are we doing?
So if that's not bad enough, they're practicing hiding under their desks in the classroom. She crawls over from one side of the room to the other, talks to the crush, and they're talking about nude pictures.
Desperately trying to get his attention, because he will not look up from his phone and until she mentions.
And he asks her about blowjobs. So again, are you good at them? And she goes, oh, by the way, yes.
Yes.
I'm great at them. So you have like a girl that's so vulnerable now that it's dangerous. So I don't think what happens later in the movie is not foreshadowed. It's beautifully foreshadowed, and it's horrifyingly foreshadowed.
Yeah, yes is my input there.
So banana American Pie awkward scene that we already analyzed happens next with the father. She's watching stuff on YouTube.
She's looking up videos how to give a good blowjob, which is a real video, by the way, from the Adam and Eve company.
And
it's in the credits.
She ends that day, again, with hope, prayer to God. Love, Kayla. She doesn't know how to end a prayer, so she's not religious.
Because the next day is the high school shadowing.
I love that Olivia girl.
Oh, she's awesome.
Her name is.
She's
I love that kid so much. What a purely kind kid. And you know these kids.
Yeah.
We work with these kids. There are kids like that.
You might still be friends with them.
Genuinely kind person who sees herself in young Kayla. So not only does Kayla have a good day, she has a great day. And she meets a genuine friend and mentor.
What a dichotomy, too. You're fresh off a scene where she's talking about, I do take dirty pictures, I give blowjobs, I do all this adult stuff. And then she's being led around by the hand by a 14-year-old in high school.
Right.
It's like you're trying to act like an adult, but you're still such a kid. Like, what the?
Like, we think she's about to break bad.
Right.
We're afraid for her. And then we're calling out for a mentor.
Oh.
Calling out for a mentor. And here she comes.
And the mentor is a sophomore in high school.
So we love that she's hanging out with Olivia. However, her friends, on the other hand, those two guys, alarm bells are sounding.
Well, one of them is hard. I saw a lot of myself in that one kid. It's like, you're just from a different generation.
No, he's fine. Yeah. But the other one is a little creepy, and they're talking
Fuck
about...
Fuck that kid.
Well, but it's again, interweaving dangerous things into the... Because you have the girl talking about a kid Instagramming her a big picture of her own feet.
Right.
So you have this pervert...
Sure.
You know, stalking her, right?
It also walks a fine line into how close kids these age are to just going off the rails into la-la land and danger at any given moment.
Right.
Like, you go from a perfectly normal lunch scene or dinner scene at the mall to the very next scene, you're right in the crest of danger. You're in Bill Cosby's lair. You know, like...
And it's amazing, too, how you work in, like, the beats going up and down, going well and going terrible. Yeah. The father spying.
He was there the whole time.
It's so important.
The car ride to them all, too. Oh, my God.
So the father is basically neutralized by the daughter. She doesn't want to take anything from him. He's happy for her that she's going out with friends.
Friends, yeah.
But he doesn't trust it based on the last time he took her to a party,
and
right?
He doesn't know her friends, yeah.
Doesn't know these friends. He does spy on them, and he's terrible at it.
Yeah.
So we realize that he is this total social idiot.
Yes.
Because, come on. You're in a fucking mall. You can't walk around.
And he can't relate either. He says it outright in the first dinner scene with Kate. He goes, I think you're so cool. You're so much cooler than I ever was at your age.
Or still is.
Yeah, I think you could do anything. And he doesn't know how to be in that world.
Because we're trying to figure out if he's truly an attentive dad or if he's truly the movie dad of every
right.
movie where the kid's basically in a, you know, every John Hughes movie where the kid is on their own and they can't relate to their parents.
Exactly.
Right. So, okay. So we have
the Home Alone parents or yeah,
we have that beautiful setup for the later scenes with the father. And then we go into the lair, right? The dragon's lair where Olivia, not really all that socially cognizant, even though she's, you know,
well,
more at home with herself.
It's
she
her
thinks
friend.
Her friend.
She wouldn't expect, I'm sure, her friend to do
well,
this.
But it's interesting that this movie's addressing why the lonely people are vulnerable, why they are prey for these fucking predators. And ugh. I don't care what you say about the age difference here. It's not that much. It's sophomore to eighth grade.
It skeeved me out.
It's still borderline illegal. There's a reason why there's that, like, everybody complains about that 17 to 15.
I mean, if they were a junior in high school, then he's 17. That's probably, it depends on the state, but it could be statutory. Yeah. I mean.
Yeah. So you know that as a law. And don't you hear, like, parents talking about, well, my daughter's dating an older boy a couple years.
And that's a
why
good point.
Why is that a law?
It's a good point you bring that up because I couldn't get over it watching it.
That's why. Yeah. This is a law, right? I mean, this is the dark side of that
probably.
Scenario. Obviously, you have
I couldn't get over it.
Perfectly like, innocent.
You gross son of a bitch. And it how hard must it have meant for that actor to be in that position, too, by the way?
So you
good for him for pulling this off.
Right. Now, you think he would be demonized for that scene, right?
No, he becomes the stereotype of why all these guys oppress these women. It's your fault. You should apologize, but don't apologize to me. I was just trying to help you by basically almost raping you.
And it's amazing how that subtext is him saying all the messed up things about himself. So Bo Burnham is very, amazingly so, charitable in that scene to the villainous character, showing how transparently lonely
don't think so.
And how transparently...
I thought it was more a commentary on the systemic oppression that women deal with.
Yes.
As far as these situations go.
Yes,
I
agree with
you. Portrayed as the victim, even when they're the ones that are... have to say no because they don't want that.
But it's the same way of that boy who says, I have this friend who has a problem.
Right.
I got this friend.
Cover,
That's what he's saying in that dialogue, literally.
See, framing it the way you did, I didn't feel any more empathy towards him.
Upon rewatch, I was like, I couldn't believe it because I figured, all right, this is one of the easier villains to just quote unquote demonize. And yet, Bo Burnham going out of the way, giving this kid a monologue to kind of get
it's
across why
he's... I took the monologue differently, but yeah, that's...
I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah.
And he does other things, like the kid gets ragged on. The reason why I think that is because the setup was the kid gets ragged on during
He's the quiet kid, yeah, he's the loner, yeah.
Right, so during that time at the mall,
this
kid is obviously socially fucked up. Okay, she goes home as a wreck. That's a heavy drama, but I'm so proud of Bo Burnham for how he shoots this. He shoots it off from a distance.
Yeah.
He does not get up into their faces with close-ups.
No, it's a tracking shot. It's up to very respectful. Stays at the doorway.
It's very respectful, and you kind of, it says so, volumes about the father-daughter relationship. You don't have to get up in there.
And the respect even that he shows the father has for Kayla in that scene, because the dad chases Kayla up to the room. She goes, sits by her bed and starts crying. And the dad sees her storming, so he chases her up to his room. And he wants to hug her, as any parent would, and she pushes him off. Mm-hmm. And he tries to, like, comfort her and rub her arm, and she pushes him off. So he respects her wishes,
right,
and stays at her side without touching her until he like feels that the time has passed enough where he can comfort her and console her, and she accepts it because he is her only comfort. And I just thought that spoke volumes too about their relationship and just another layer again, to their father daughter.
But it still kind of sets up the climax, right?
Sure.
Because the father is unable to help her. Yes, he's there for her,
right,
but he's still kind of failing her. Well, in it's many ways, more, right?
And again, I took it a little bit. I just took it as he was going to let her grow up and he was going to fit in wherever she allowed him to.
Now, he doesn't necessarily know, which is why the scene is so excellent, the whole sequence is so excellently written. Because he is still just, I'm sure he's murdering himself inside, right, for spying and getting caught spying, sure, and making her feel
awkward.
That's
why awkward. He threw a 20
and up. So guilty. Yeah, so he is not necessarily, he doesn't know if she's just crying because of him.
Right? Oh, good point. Honestly. I didn't think of that. Yeah.
I mean,
good point.
So that it's a brilliantly written scene. Now we have her at rock bottom. She ends her videos. She does a farewell video.
So sad.
Sad. I don't remember when she gets the text from Gabe. At some point, she gets a text from Gabe, like during that Act 2, Act 3 break. Right. So this is like Act 2 to Act 3. So the act.
Well, he sends a DM thanking her for following him on Instagram.
And she kind of ignores it and just kind of flips her phone over. She's sad about it in a way, right? Because this is not her crush. This is the nerdy kid.
Right. And it's not a step towards being in with the cool kids. It's a step backwards to her. Yeah.
I think one of the bigger moments of the movie is she walks downstairs, asks her dad for help.
Can you help me burn something in the backyard? Her dad, sure. That was so funny.
It's
because, again, he's just following her lead the whole movie. He doesn't want to get in the way of her maturing the way she needs to.
So, yes, my best scene working into it now is the back and forth of them at the fire. You get a little bit of a funny setup, like, well, what is this? I hope this is positive. I'm just burning all my hopes,
all
and
my
dreams.
Hopes and dreams. And this is a good thing.
Essentially, she asks him if he is sad. Basically, her, if he's ashamed of her.
Right.
You know, you should be ashamed of me. I'm ashamed of me.
Right.
You should be ashamed of me. Convince me not to be ashamed of me. And this is as blatant a call for help.
It's her
a
martyrdom.
Cry for help.
It's her martyrdom.
To her father. Yeah. Essentially finally giving him the opportunity to speak to her. And the first 2 minutes of his monologue, he could not botch it worse.
Well, yeah, but how would you react in that scenario, you know?
Right. Deer in headlights.
What
trying
can you
to
do?
Say all these he's saying all these
cliche. It's like me
things.
At the beginning of this episode saying, hey, Mike, do we ever really progress from eighth grade? It's like, how can you be ready for that?
He's saying all these cliched things about, oh, I'm so proud of you. And then she's not buying it worth a shit.
Of course.
And then he says, you know what? Well, my mom, when your mom left, and then bang,
it's
he drops.
The first reference to the mother, by the way, right, throughout the movie, and that's, I'm going to talk about that later on, but yeah.
And he drops a Mystic River level, Sean Penn level, Michael Stuhlbarg level speech of father's love for a daughter there that I just couldn't get over, and I'm so proud of seeing this movie and feeling that like we were of the Michael Stuhlbarg speech from
Absolutely.
Call Me By Your Name last year. It was just It was so brilliantly set up, and then obviously that is the payoff, and she burns the coolest girl in the world box, and now she has, in the falling action of Act 3, many things to do where she, many accounts to recommend. She's got to tell off the cool
Tie
kids.
Up loose ends. Yeah, she goes to the cool. I gave you a nice note, and when someone does something nice, you're supposed to be nice to them. It does
exactly.
This. And she couldn't even maintain eye contact throughout the whole thing, but she still walks away feeling satisfied that she stood up for herself.
And, of course, she's got to go on the play date, essentially, with Gabe. Which is
how,
the most awkward thing ever, but it's adorable.
Fucking heartwarming was that date with Gabe.
All the sauces laid out.
I've got two of each sauces. And if you find you want one more, I would be happy to give you mine.
And again, it's just a kind kid. And it's so remarkable to see a kid that's just, everything he does is kind. And he, it's.
And the tension that Kayla felt all movie between being yourself and being accepted by the cool kids. And she's able to quickly, you know, she's hesitant at first with Gabe, but she's quickly able to find common ground about Rick and Morty and about love for chicken nuggets.
They can talk about anything, but essentially she's realizing I'd rather be friends with a kid.
Exactly.
A good kid and a kind
person.
That
lets me be myself. That accepts me for me.
Exactly. Right. Going right back to the beginning of the movie. And of course, the resolution of all this is the Coolest Girl in the World box remade.
There you go.
From graduated eighth grader to buried in the yard as a time capsule for the graduating high schooler. So now I found this as a double-edged sword in a way, because she's setting her up with kind of setting herself up in many ways for the same dashing of expectations, correct?
But it's also kind of a rising of the phoenix moment.
And
she's evolved. She's the sixth grade Kayla is not the eighth grade Kayla. And the eighth grade Kayla is kind of evolving into the high school Kayla. And now, so maybe 4 years later, she can evolve again. I think it's something that everyone can relate to, because we all had personal landmarks in our life where we were done with our past and kind of ready to move on from that point.
And the maturity is there, right? The coming of age literally is there when she says, but you know what? If you have a shitty high school experience,
That's okay. Yeah.
You know, and that's like the silver lining that comes out of it, because yes, it could be just her, you know, the cycle of
she's growing as a
disappointment.
Person. Yeah.
But no, you get that little wisdom tacked on at the
more
end. That's
adult
why
perspective.
I think this is really is a smart script. And I mean, this is just a couple viewings that we've had of it. We're going to analyze it throughout Oscar time, compare and contrast, but there's no need for me to go through my best scenes. I kind of gushed
about
them. Yeah,
I said my best scene, the pool scene, obviously. The score for me, I was blown away throughout the entirety of the score. Worst scene, you said you didn't have one.
I don't have one. I know this movie makes you suffer. And I would say worst scene is, I suffered with this movie.
It's purposeful suffering, though. But you're right. You do. It makes you crawl out of your skin.
So it's a tough watch. And that's why a lot of people aren't going to see this in droves. Here's the thing. The trailer lets you know it's going to be tough.
Right. I don't have a worst scene either, per se. The mother. Okay. The mother's absence is pretty much the MacGuffin of this movie, right? It's there. It's very pronounced, but it's never addressed except for one line of dialogue at the very end of the movie when the father's giving the speech to Kayla.
Right.
And it's not even really addressed that much. It's just said, when your mother left. So we assume that she didn't die. We assume she left them behind. Who knows?
Yeah.
Maybe that's his way of dealing with her dying. I don't know. I can see that this is such a snapshot about a place in life or a moment in time, and people are going to want to psychologically analyze why Kayla has done stuff that she did, because this is such a psychological movie in a way. It's very anxiety driven, very, very in her head. As you said, Bo Burnham said he wanted the audience to be. I can see people getting upset for not having more about the mother's absence. I could see that, in that they wanted to form a more psychological picture about her reasoning and justifying her actions. Right. I don't have a problem with it.
Yeah, I don't care.
I think it was fine.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think you need a Hamlet's ghost of his father at the beginning of this.
Right.
Ghost of the mother. I'm with you. I don't have a problem with it.
So I don't, again, I don't have a worse scene per
here's
se.
Here's my thing. I did not read a single review. I did not watch a YouTube review. I didn't want to know. I glanced at the Rotten Tomatoes stuff, so I knew people liked it a lot. And I did not glance at the Metascore at all either until after I prepared this morning. I was like, fucking 90.
Yeah. Whoa. Unbelievable.
I kind of wanted to do this blind, you know, so who knows? Maybe everybody thinks.
Oh, I'm with you. I only read one or two reviews, and they didn't really address it, but I was just thinking from my perspective how I would digest movies at an earlier age. I could see that being an issue. Again, I'm fine with it the way it was handled. This is obviously a watch for us.
Watch.
What do you have for a grade?
After my first watch, I had it at a B+89.
Okay.
After my second watch, I have it as an A-92.
Oh, wow. 92.
Bumped it way up there because I did not recognize the level of dramatic
That's
sophistication.
High, yeah. I am a B+89. That's exactly where I have it. So
we'll see it again.
Of the same mind, yeah. And I've only seen it once so far.
You're also the
times.
Tougher grader, so.
Right? So but the bottom line is, it's up there, and we hope that it maintains and sustains this momentum that it seems to be having towards Oscar season. I think we both think that this movie is worthy of, it has to be nominated for a big category.
Yes.
It may not win, but it deserves to have its name, as you hear my dog losing her shit upstairs. It may not win, but it deserves to be recognized, at least in that sense. And I would be thrilled to see Bo Burnham go from YouTube sensation to Oscar nominated director / screenwriter / whatever.
We are rooting for this movie, and we will continue to analyze it as we go. Don't judge us too harshly for these takes, but I don't know. I'm feeling pretty.
Yeah, I stand by. I stand by what we said. If you want to disagree with us, bring it on. I'll slap you down. I don't care.
I think this is an Oscars movie. This movie feels like an Oscars movie to me.
We'll see what happens as it goes along, but guys, reality does suck. Keep watching movies with us. Definitely go see 8th Grade. You can reach out to us. Let us know what you thought about 8th Grade, the movie, or Bo Burnham, or Elsie Fisher, any of the performances therein or movies related to. Mike and Oscar on Facebook, Mike and Oscar on Instagram, MM and Oscar on Twitter, MikeMikeAndOscar@gmail.com, on Reddit.com. We're everywhere. Type in Mike and Oscar. Please both give us a review on iTunes. We would really appreciate, but also definitely check out Casual Cinecast, In Session Films, Next Best Picture. I'd really appreciate that as well.
So, Mike, I think this is a good conversation, right? You're having fun? for the last scene!
I know what you're doing! I know what you're doing! Are those your words of wisdom that we're going to end on?
Sure. I refuse to say Gucci at the end of this thing, so yes.
All right, guys, we'll check you out next time.
See ya.